I have a trivia question for you. Do you know the Pillsbury
Muffin
Doughboy?
Man. That's pretty close. I don't.
You don't know the Pillsbury Doughboy?
I mean, I do, but not like personally. Is that what are you asking?
I wasn't asking personally. You know of him. Like, you know, you
Yes.
can picture him in your okay. He has a little like woohoo if someone like pokes him, which is I feel violated watching him with that.
Okay.
Anyway, did you know he has a name?
Nope.
I guess you don't know what it is.
I don't, actually.
It is Poppin' Fresh. Poppin' Space Fresh, the Doughboy.
That was a terrible name.
I mean, I didn't come up with it. It was on a trivia I had earlier. So do these like trivia things with
That's a horrible name.
yeah, Poppin' Fresh. But it's Poppin, not even a G. Might be better that way. He's cool that way.
Huh.
Anywho, how's life been for you? Oh,
Hello! And welcome to the Under the Waves podcast, a show about all things shipwrecks and poppin' fresh and more on the Great Lakes. My name's Andrew, your captain for today's mayhem.
and I'm Michelle, the mayhem bringer, which is more makes more sense now than ever
Yes,
before. Welcome
indeed.
aboard this week's episode. I put a question mark. Welcome aboard this week's episode. No, episode. It's exciting. So, we're gonna do a catch up on our last episode, which was dinghy number three, all about shark stories. And man, I'm glad our voices are back to being normal.
Quite strange.
I don't know what happened there, but while our editor was prepping the release of our last episode, they noticed that our voices sounded off, and no matter what they did, they couldn't figure out what happened. So hopefully it doesn't come off sounding too weird to our listeners, but we did start off today's recording with a sound check just to make sure, and it sounded fine to us. So we'll just keep an eye out on that going forward to make sure it doesn't happen again or too often.
You never
But
know.
yeah, never know. Your voice got real high, I'll tell you that. But I think I had like a cold or something. But yeah, let's go with the stories that were shared and see how close we got to figuring out what was true and what was false. And if you haven't listened to that episode yet, what are you even doing? Go listen. We'll wait. Okay, you good? You good now? You
I'm
back?
still
You
waiting.
did, oh, I'll wait. I'm not patient. That's long enough. You can pause it if you need longer.
I think that's good.
That was almost a tragedy. Good thing we caught it in time. Now, you ready? Let's rock and roll. Would you like to go with our
So,
first story?
our first story, it was about two fishermen out fishing for a special type of salmon when they pulled in a 29-inch shark. This happened in Lake Michigan off of the Milwaukee shore back in 1966. The shark was already dead, and a local tavern owner, William Bathke, claimed that he had caught the shark in Florida a few years prior, brought it back, kept it in his freezer, and a few of his customers took it out and let it loose as a prank. And this story is true. There really was a frozen shark that was released into Lake Michigan, and it really did cause a stir amongst the locals. I wonder if he ever got fined for it, or if it was just more of a camaraderie and humor of it all to let him get off the hook. Pun was intended, and I do apologize for the violence you just endured.
It was good violence. I mean, not for the shark, but you know what? That sounded weird. Scratch that. It was good humor. I don't know what you're talking about. Our next story was about a boy named George Lawson who was swimming near a boat off the coast of Chicago in the summer of 1955 when a shark came up and ripped off his right leg. He was rescued by the brave John Adler and didn't succumb to his injuries. The shark's dorsal fin was spotted by several people that day in the boat, and the shark was thought to be a requiem shark, more specifically a bull shark. And while bull sharks do adapt to freshwater sometimes and have been found hundreds to 1,000 miles away from the ocean, this story is false. There are records of both a George Lawson and a John Adler that would have happened around the same time, but none have been able to give a testimony about that day, and no shark was ever seen in that area prior to or after the incident. I guess yay for George's right leg to remain intact.
That's good. That's
Yeah.
good. That I mean, if that story was true, that really would have stumped me.
And you didn't like my joke? Rude.
And story three was about the discovery of a two-headed bull shark being confirmed by Michigan State University along with Florida Keys Community College back in 2011. A fisherman caught a shark, released its unborn but alive babies back into the water, but kept the two-headed one who died shortly after. Also, what is it with all the bull sharks? This wild story is actually true. This was the first recorded instance of, you need to say that,
Dicephalia
in a shark. There are actual pictures of it, and we'll have to check with our social media manager if the picture was posted with the last episode or if we're doing it here, so please stay tuned. Also going along with that story, do you recall the Sonic Hedgehog protein being a major part of embryo development and oftentimes misfirings lead to conjoined twins like this shark? That is a true term. May the Lord have mercy on whoever made that term. There are also hedgehog genes, desert hedgehog, Indian hedgehog, as well as Sonic, not the hedgehog, but just Sonic Hedgehog. The hedgehog term comes from the malfunction or loss of function from the HH or hedgehog phenotype, causing the embryos initially to be covered with denticles, otherwise known as small pointy projections resembling those of a hedgehog. Folks, I'm sorry for this. I don't even know what we're talking. These were first observed in fruit flies and published about in the 1980s. Feel free to do your own deep dives on it, as our researcher's head it's no longer with us, basically. With the reintroduction of phenotypes, genotypes, segmentations, genetics, and homologous genes. Okay. It's been a minute since any of us in this team has taken a class on those terms, maybe my wife.
To tout our ages, but also it's been a hot minute since I've done anything with biology and genome tracking and stuff. And it's like, I've heard these terms before. Yeah, our researcher couldn't ask me any questions. I had no clue.
That was a hard one to go through. So thank you for giving me that to read.
You're welcome. The fourth story jumped back to 1981 with a freshwater shark study to be held in three different northern Michigan lakes. The $1.3 million project would introduce 2,000 sharks into the lakes, including types like blue sharks, hammerheads, and a few great whites. Much outrage from locals was had, but the experiment proceeded anyways. This story was false. If it didn't come off when you first heard it last time. It was true that it was printed in some local papers, but as an April Fool's joke. The ending of the original publication, which our researcher discreetly left off, said, quote, "The report concluded by again quoting the National Biological Foundation representative, who said that, quote, we can't be responsible for people if they are attacked, besides anyone foolish enough to believe all this deserves to be eaten." Quote,
that's
end
brutal.
Quote. They that have is such it. Such a burn. A bona fide false story.
Oh, man.
We couldn't include that. That would have been too obvious if the story itself wasn't obvious.
And rude for us to say that.
Story I didn't come up with it.
Starts to bring us back to more present day with a zoo worker named Nick, who was part of identifying a shark found in Lake Erie on July 28, 2002. This almost 3 foot long or 1 meter long adult male shark, most likely an Atlantic sharp-nosed shark, was also found by a local fisherman. This story is a bit harder to corroborate with anything else, but for all we know, the story is, who knows? The story was published in American Currents, which is the quarterly journal of the North American Native Fishes Association, and is a real group. Their focus is on, quote, finding, collecting, rearing, observing, conserving, breeding, and the biology and ecology of North American fishes and their habitats, end quote. That's quite a slogan.
Succinct.
It rolls off the tongue. Other than this source, the story wasn't found in any other publications, reputable or not. There were a few articles around the same time in 2002 that claimed a shark was photographed swimming in Lake Erie, but those pictures were said to have been actually taken in Cape Canaveral, Florida, and not Lake Erie. The jury is still out on this one. The thing that made it weird is that it was published in July, not on April 1st, like a lot of hoax stories were. So, who knows?
I was talking to a researcher earlier. It sounded pretty real, honestly. A lot of like facts that went into it, but just the fact that we couldn't back it up to anything else. I don't know. I don't feel comfortable saying like, yeah, it's true.
Say it with me now. Big if true.
Yeah, and small if false.
That would be the inverse, indeed.
The final story was about the Kodiak sharks taking over Lake Michigan by storm. These 65 to 70 foot long monstrosities of sharks were attacking both swimmers and divers alike. Anyone going in the water wasn't safe. There are also rumored reports of Corwell Health Lakeland Hospital having to care for shark bite victims. And while whale sharks are actually this long at their longest recorded lengths, this story is false. Kodiak sharks are a made-up type of shark that doesn't even exist. There's also rumors that warming temperatures brought about by climate change are pushing sharks and other species further north to find the warmer waters that used to be cold. This phenomenon has been documented as some fish species are altering their geographic range in response to climate change, but not sharks migrating into the Great Lakes. There are no freshwater sharks in the wild. Quite a few species can adapt, like we discussed in the last episode, such as the bull shark, but most prefer to be in saltwater for at least part of their lives, if not the majority of it. There are aquarium freshwater sharks, and while they are called sharks, they're technically not related to sharks. So, yeah, how many did you guys get correct? Let us know. Send us an email. Will you be willing to jump into the Great Lakes this summer knowing that there are no sharks in it, at least none that are native?
Well, I mean, we can't guarantee that there are none now.
That's not all a comforting.
All the stories were from the history of the past.
It's not a comforting thought for me, being like, well, there's supposed to be no sharks, but doesn't mean there aren't no sharks.
That's true. I mean, no salt, no sharks. That's only true until someone spills the table salt into the bay.
Wow. I was so excited for this to pan out.
Well, I'm sorry to disappoint. That was fell on my face with that one.
I'll get you a band-aid. It's okay.
How many physicists does it take to change a light bulb?
Physicists?
Uh-huh.
Three, but I don't know why.
It takes all of them. Two to twist the light bulb and everyone else to rotate the universe or something like that.
That's funny.
Or no, one to hold the light bulb and anyway, let's get into it. I forgot.
Stop with the jokes while you're ahead. Oh my gosh.
Well, that all being said, let's get into today's story. That's right, we still haven't done that yet. So
yeah,
let's
you're
get
welcome.
Into today's story. We're stepping way back. And we're covering the SS Ohio, was it even real, and the schooner barge Ironton.
You're going to piss off a lot of people in Ohio someday. I'm waiting for the emails to come in and be like, Ohio's real.
If you're from Ohio, can you please write us at underthewayspodcast@gmail.com. Is Ohio real? And if you don't know what that means, please don't think that I'm delusional. It's something that's in...
Is it a reference?
I think it's Gen Z something or other. It's something... Skibbity toilet, or I don't know, something about Ohio being real or not, and birds being government agents. It's a whole
I heard that. Yeah. I haven't heard the Ohio not real. I thought you were just saying it to say it.
No, it's one of those things that generate, like, I think it's a thing where kids are just like, oh, Ohio isn't real. I don't know. Anyway, it's just a joke. Please know that it's recognize it as one of the 50 states.
It's like Boomers Say Virginia's for Lovers. The Gen Z says Ohio isn't real.
Sure.
It's the same thing. Put it on a shirt.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Well, the SS Ohio was built in 1875 by John F. Squires of Huron, Ohio. She was launched in April of 1875 and officially placed into service on May 29th of that year. The Ohio was a 202.2 foot long early wooden bulk carrier steamship. She had a beam of 35 feet and a depth of 18.5 feet. And for our metric lovers, that's 61.6 meters long, 11 meters wide, 5.6 meters deep. And to keep going with the numbers, the Ohio had a gross tonnage of 1,108.81 tons and a net tonnage of 850.82 tons. And it is with...
Sorry, I was just trying to find where the Ohio meme came in, and I'm this is all confusing.
You're so showing your age there.
I probably lost in Ohio. Oh no, said help.
It is with much regret that we tell you, our fine listeners, that the Ohio was powered by a low-pressure condensing engine that was fueled by a single coal-burning Scotch marine boiler. No triple expansion steam engine to be found here. Those wouldn't show up in the Great Lakes area until the late 1880s. And to put it into terms that even Michelle can hopefully understand, in Hello. A low-pressure condensing steam engine, water is heated up, which creates steam. The steam has a higher pressure than water and its surroundings and pushes the turbine. And if you let that steam go, you'll get a force. However, if you just let it go, you're getting the force of the steam's pressure minus the atmosphere. But if one was to condense the steam back to water only to reboil it, you'd create a vacuum. This helps to get the entire force of the steam pressure that was just created out into moving a steamboat along. Exhausting the steam into a vacuum rather than just letting it go requires less energy input for the same amount of work. In a condensing steam engine, the condenser is used to condense exhaust steam. Also, they're able to recycle and reuse that water that was turned into steam, so therefore it is a more efficient process as well.
I'm glad you have this, because I tried looking up condenser and it showed me like a flux capacitor and I have no clue what I'm doing anymore.
So yeah, I did some looking into it too. I really couldn't find anything about a low pressure condensing steam engine, but I did find out different information on steam engines and why they use condensers and things like that. It's pretty cool. I can't guarantee that it's the same technology or same, you know, whatever application is what they had in this boat. But yeah, do some looking into it. If you guys want the audience, it's pretty cool. But yeah, they use it in modern steam energy production today. Those cooling towers that you see, like if you're next to like if you go by a nuclear power plant or some other power plant where they use steam power and you see those big cooling towers, those are condensing towers. And basically it's so they can reuse the water and also cool it down a bit. And you get that increased efficiency from the whole thing with the atmosphere, which I didn't fully understand, but you know, I'm not a physicist or scientist.
This is going to be a really, really dumb question to show where I'm at in this conversation. Is a condenser to condense the steam back into water?
You got it.
Oh my gosh.
Good job. We're all proud of you.
So dumb. I mean, this is coming from someone who just found out a couple weeks ago that stainless steel meant that it doesn't stain. That is not a type of steel.
You know, you might not be the brightest light, but you still shine. So...
offended. Oh my gosh.
Well, the Ohio was also fueled by a single coal burning. You didn't know that stainless steel meant that it couldn't
stain? I assumed that it was a type of steel. And to be fair, when I asked a couple of my friends and my husband, they're like, wait, what? That means that? So I don't know what that tells about me surrounding myself with people who also don't know. But I thought it was for some reason like, it's like, oh, it's like tin foil. It's like foil made out of tin. It's stainless steel. It's steel made out of stainless. It made sense. I never had to think about it.
The Ohio was also fueled by a single coal-burning Scotch marine boiler, which was just to say that it was a certain design of steam boiler that is best known for being used on ships. So, good thing it was on the ship. During her life, the Ohio was used to haul bulk cargoes of mainly iron ore, coal, and grain.
Sorry, I'm watching. Let me go get the door real quick. Oh my gosh.
No.
Chris is stressing. I guess he's been doing that for 15 minutes. Didn't hear him. Oops.
Well, during her life, the Ohio...
Sorry. Kids.
During her life, the Ohio was used to haul bulk cargoes of mainly iron ore, coal, and grain across the Great Lakes. This would all tragically end in September of 1894. The Ohio departed from Duluth, Minnesota, fully loaded with grain and downbound for Ogdensburg, New York. Most of the recent ships we've covered tend to stay in the same handful of lakes. This trip would take the Ohio across Lake Superior, through the Sioux Locks, into Lake Huron, through the St. Clair River and Lake, across Lake Erie, then Lake Ontario, and partway up the St. Lawrence River, which is quite the journey. We were going to look up on Savvy Navi app just what that distance and journey would look like, but it was giving us some issues. Not sure if it's because we reached the end of our free trial period or if it's because our light only shines so bright. But just know that the Ohio was planning on hitting four out of the four Great Lakes. Four out of the four.
I said four out of five.
Let's your light so shine.
I am ashamed of myself. I think I'm going to mute the rest of the episode. It's just on you.
But just know that the Ohio... I need to stop smiling so much.
You're welcome. I'm good for something.
But just know that the Ohio was planning on hitting four out of the five Great Lakes and traveling the length of all of them.
Well, at least I said all of them.
Surprisingly, the Ohio made it through the Superior part of her journey, but when she reached Huron, she encountered heavy weather. Here's where our second ship comes into play. The Ironton was a 190.9-foot, or 58.2-meter, long schooner barge with a beam of 35.4 feet, 10.8 meters, and a gross tonnage of 785.56 tons. She could carry more than 48,500 bushels of grain, and recall that a bushel for wheat is around 60 pounds, or 27 kilograms. She was built by George Nodder out of Buffalo, New York, and launched in 1873. During this trip, the Ironton was traveling light from Ashtabula, Ohio, upbound to Marquette, Michigan, a port city on Lake Superior. Being a schooner barge, the Ironton was being towed by the steamship Charles J. Kershaw, who was also towing behind it another schooner barge called the Moonlight. All three vessels were headed north and upbound. Despite being under tow, the Ironton was being run by Captain Peter Girard. The bad weather hit them around 10 miles or 16 kilometers north of Presque Isle, Michigan. Around the same time, the Kershaw was having issues and her engine failed around 12:30 a.m. on September 26, 1894, just a few miles north of the Presque Isle Lighthouse. Both the Ironton and the Moonlight disconnected their tow lines and drifted apart to more than likely avoid a collision with their tow ship due to the strong southerly wind and waves. The Ironton crew, finding themselves suddenly adrift, went to work setting their sails and firing up the engine when the ship veered off course and ran smack dab into the side of the oncoming Ohio. Sources seemed to flip between the tow line, between all three ships snagging, causing the Ironton to enter the path of the Ohio, to all the boats making the conscious decision to detach themselves to the Moonlight, letting go of the Ironton. So multiple different iterations of stories. Choose whichever one you like most, I guess.
It's a choose your own adventure. Somehow the Ironton was disconnected from the rest of the ships and was on its own, whether it snapped like in the wind and waves, whether it was cut loose from the Moonlight, whether it was consciously detached, like whatever it was, like it was detached is the end result.
Gotcha. William Woolley from Cleveland, Ohio, was on board the Ironton that night, recounted his experience to the Duluth News Tribune. Quote, "At this time, we sighted a steamer on our starboard bow. She came up across our bow, and we struck her on the quarter about aft of the boiler house. A light was lowered over our bow, and we saw a hole in our port bow and our stem splintered." End quote. The two ships separated after the impact, but both were fatally damaged. The Ironton's bowhead tore a 12-foot diameter hole into the Ohio's wooden hull. Heavily loaded with cargo, the Ohio foundered almost immediately, most sources saying she sank in about 30 minutes. The damaged Ironton drifted away and out of sight of most responding vessels, taking anywhere from 30 minutes to an hour to sink. All 16 on board the Ohio made it into their lifeboats and were able to be picked up by the crew on board the Moonlight. The Ohio's first mate was found clinging onto a ladder and was later picked up by the Kershaw. CBSNews.com said that the Ironton's crew and captain, quote, clambered into a lifeboat, but it was dragged to the bottom before they could attach it from the ship, end quote. Apparently, in all of the commotion of the collision and fighting to save the Ironton thereafter, no one had untied the painter, which was a line that secured the lifeboat to the Ironton. Survivor William W. Perry from East China, Michigan, later told the Duluth News Tribune, quote, then the Ironton sank, taking the yawl with her. As the painter was not untied, I sank underwater, and when I came up, grabbed a sailor's bag. Wooly was a short distance from me on a box. I swam to where he was, end quote. Both men would be picked up by another passing steamship, the Charles. Both men would be picked up by another passing steamship, the Charles Hebbard. Unfortunately, the other five crew perished, including Captain Gerard, Mate Ted Bostwick, Sailor John Pope, and two unidentified sailors. The Ohio wouldn't be seen again until May 23, 2017, when researchers from the Thunder Bay National Marine Sanctuary discovered two shipwrecks deep in the waters of Lake Huron, just off the coast of Presque Isle, Michigan. Between June and August of that year, researchers carried out several investigations, which would end up confirming the identities of the two ships, the steel-hulled steamer Choctaw and the Ohio. And y'all know the drill by now, the Choctaw will be covered in a future episode, so stay tuned. But spoiler alert, you already found it. As is standard in a lot of ship-finding procedures, the Thunder Bay National Marine Sanctuary did not announce their finding of the Ohio nor the Choctaw wrecks until September of 2017. During this time, some hobby shipwreck hunters continued to search for the Choctaw. While searching for this ship, independent researchers Dan Fountain and Kurt Fosberg found the Ohio on July 15, 2017, while using a modified fish finder. A few weeks later, on July 30, Fountain returned to the site along with veteran shipwreck hunters Ken Merriman and Jerry Eliason to photograph the wreck with Eliason's homemade high-definition drop video system. The men were able to positively identify the wreck as the Ohio. She is now laying completely preserved in nearly 300 feet or 91 meters of cold Lake Huron water. She sits upright with a list to her starboard side, and her foremast is still standing. Her wooden pilot house with its double helm wheel remains completely intact. However, near the stern, her mizzen mast is still standing, but its top mast has broken off. She is in the plans to be nominated as being listed under the National Register of Historic Places.
Also, before we get into all the pictures and stuff, there's a few pictures of the Ohio before she sank, and then there's one picture we could find after, versus there's no pictures of the Ironton before she sank, but there's a bunch of them after. So maybe it's a give and take, but also if we find more, we'll post what we can find.
Yeah, and if you have more pictures, if you've been there, you've seen it, you've documented it with your own eyes, please feel free to send us the pictures on delayspodcast@gmail.com. We would be eternally grateful.
Delighted.
According to Michael Levinson from the New York Times, researchers from the Marine Sanctuary partnered with Ocean Exploration Trust. Does that group sound familiar? They were the group known for finding the Titanic in 1985.
Before it even sank. Before it was even built, they found it.
They were the group known for finding the Titanic in 1985. This group embarked on a mapping expedition. Using sonar imaging, they were able to find the Ironton's location in 2019. The final resting place of the Ironton has been photographed and is several miles away from the Ohio. However, the exact location or depth of the ship are unknown, except that it is a couple of hundred feet down. The Thunder Bay National Marine Sanctuary plans to put a buoy over the wreck, marking her location. We do know that the Ironton still sits upright and intact, all three masts still standing, and that she was found in 2019 by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration researchers, or NOAA.
Also, I don't know if I put this in here or not, but you'll see it in the pictures. Her life raft that was not the yawl, that was not detached, is still attached to her.
Crazy.
Eerily enough. Like, it's right behind her stern in photos, and it's creepy just to... Oh, they were
know
right
the
there.
History of it. Yeah, that's really... Yeah, that's interesting.
It's dark.
At the time of the ship's finding, Jeff Gray, a superintendent of the Marine Sanctuary, said, quote, "It is hard to call it a shipwreck. It's a ship sitting on the bottom, fully intact, and the lifeboat there literally is a moment frozen in time. We have not only located a pristine shipwreck lost for over a century, we are also learning more about one of our nation's most important natural resources, the Great Lakes," end quote. We'll include photos of the well-preserved barge. Eerily enough, her lifeboat is still tied to her and rests now at her stern, as previously mentioned.
I forgot to put that in there.
Wow, that is crazy.
It's, like, so pristine, this wreck.
It's like it just gently just settled into the bottom.
Yeah.
Yeah, having the lifeboat right there, that really is crazy.
It's so, like, it's so daunting. And that's so, like, well-preserved and stuff. Yeah, you guys gotta see these photos. You gotta look at, check out our socials, which we'll list in a few minutes. But yeah, definitely look at them. They bring this story to life. Also, I hadn't seen a point cloud image
thing before. Cool.
I don't understand the science because I didn't look it up. But it's a new way to look at a ship, and it looks almost like a heat map. Which is weird. I don't think that's what it is, though, because it's this is extracted from water column returns from
that's
a multi-beam sonar. That sounds way sciencey for my little lit brain, but it looks really cool, and you can see all the masts and rigging and stuff, like they say.
Yeah. There's a meow meow behind you.
Yeah, I had to move the plant because he was trying to eat it. This is serious. Like, serious?
Why am I so serious, son?
That's what Chris says. He's like, why so serious? Don't jump in that. That's going to hurt. Okay, well, jump wherever you want.
Some cool quotes we thought deserved to be mentioned about the Ohio and the Choctaw specifically are, quote, "These remarkable discoveries remind us that the mystery is still out there. There are still shipwrecks to find. Our team is excited to further document Ohio and Choctaw and tell their stories. We'll keep looking for other wrecks and working to ensure that these treasures are preserved for future generations," end quote. Jeff Gray, Thunder Bay National Marine Sanctuary's superintendent. And, quote, "Ohio and Choctaw are remarkable examples of two very significant Great Lakes watercraft, and both are beautifully preserved. Virtually all of their rigging and deck hardware is intact, and there is clear evidence of the accidents that claimed both vessels. Talk about keeping history alive," end quote. Charles Patrick Labadee, maritime historian. And that, folks, is the story of the SS Ohio and the schooner barge Ironton.
Thank you. Good job.
Thank you. You too.
I am just trying here. That's all I'm doing. So, last week's trivia, there was none. And this week's trivia looks like there is none as well. So, we hope you find yourself back around our neck of the woods next week for more Great Lake and shipwreck stories. Give us a follow on the socials where you can peruse the photos that go along with each episode. Our social media manager works hard to find some good pics, which isn't always the easiest with some of these older ships. So see how she did this week at Instagram, which is at Under the Waves Podcast, and Facebook, Under the Waves Podcast. Send us an email if there's a wreck you want us to cover at underthewavespodcast@gmail.com. And remember that all of our sources are listed on our show notes page on our website, www.underthewavespodcast.com. There should also be a link to it in our episode description for each episode, no matter your listening platform. And if you're listening and you drank at least 64 ounces of water today, drop us a like and or a follow. Andy's checking his ounces.
I've only drank like 38 ounces today.
Oh, no.
And probably half of that was in the last 2 hours.
Uh-oh.
I didn't drink much today. Please do better than me, folks.
I didn't yesterday, and I'm paying for today. So I'm actually on my third water bottle today, and they're 32 ounces. So
if you drink less than 64 ounces of water today, you're invited to be a guest host, because I haven't done 64 ounces either. But anyway.
Stay to Andrew's standards.
I'm going to finish this bottle today, though.
What's the bottle? 32?
It's a 48 ounce now,
Jim. Oh, wow.
Yeah, that's all I got left. Probably like 6 ounces. Oh, nope.
You could do that in the next 2 minutes if you really wanted to.
Guys, I got to say some words, though, so I can't do it. We'll share this.
That was like the ventriloquist where you can talk and drink water.
My light does not shine that bright either. Share this episode with your second cousin's first child. So that would be your parent's cousin's kid, I think. Or better yet, share it with your first cousin. Probably easier to find out who that is without having to go all the way to the ancestry site or something like that. Plus, this way you shouldn't have to contact your family members you might or might not want to, trying to figure out who your second cousin's first kid might be. And if you're not as close to your family, share this with someone who you consider to be a cousin, which could dictate cousin status versus friend. I'm not sure. Perhaps they're close, almost too close, uncomfortably close, yet you have to love them because you're cousins. Or maybe it's more along the lines of some... I almost held it together.
I love this for you.
Or maybe it's more along the lines of someone you wish was super close, but you stay a little bit further away from them and you're left longing for that closeness. That almost sounds kind of stalkerish, so you know what? Don't take our word for it. Share this with whomever you deem as a cousin for your own personal reasons. Yeah, do that. That sounds better. And we claim no responsibility for weird encounters. That's on you, but thank you for sharing.
We release new episodes every Friday, and for all of you wondering, a huge shout out and thank you to our awesome spouses for taking on the role of running through our April Fool's episode. Their lovely voices brought you the wonderful shark stories you got to hear about last week. So huge shout out to Nicole and Chris.
Mm-hmm. And until the next episode, fair winds and following seas.
We'll catch you next time under the waves. Bye!
Cheers.
With or without your cousin.